Hi everyone, I'm your host NG, and welcome to the 51st episode of the podcast, Sounds About Right, Audiobooks Help Us Understand the World. And on this episode, I was joined by David Delmar Centillas, author of the book What We Build With Power, The Fight for Economic Justice in Tech. And the book is an urgent call for organising shared strategies in order to disrupt the tech industry and move towards a more economically inclusive and equitable workforce. And in it, David uses his first-hand experience as the founder of Resilient Coders, a free and stipended non-profit bootcamp that trains people of colour from low-income communities for careers as software engineers, to highlight how we must identify and dismantle the intentional systemic barriers in tech that are precluding non-white people from participating in their city's prosperity. He shows how diversity and inclusion initiatives fail, reveals how philanthropic efforts often exacerbate racial inequalities, and argues for a total overhaul of tech culture. It was great discussing the book with him, and I hope you enjoyed the episode. I want to start off by highlighting how this is a subject that's very close to you as you run Resilient Coders. What was the reason behind putting this organization, for lack of a better term, together?
Yeah, back in 2014, I started Resilient Coders largely because of the fact that I was Latino in tech, right? And at least in my town, Boston, you look around and it's just hard to find other Latinos in tech. And so I didn't quite know what to do at the time other than to teach. And so I just started volunteering my time, spending down my vacation days, teaching young men, actually in detention centers early on, how to code. And then from there, it turned into a whole organization and the very competitive, free and stipended coding bootcamp that it eventually became.
And yeah, you highlight early on just how small the representation of Latinxs as well as other minorities such as African Americans there are in tech as well, especially in a place such as Boston, where it has quite a high tech industry there, doesn't it?
It does. People don't necessarily know that, but Boston, by venture dollars, is the biggest startup hub east of California in the States.
And there's also a part in the book when you say, as long as paying for education is the responsibility of the student, we will continue to see a disparity of wealth in America. Why is this the case?
Well, because education has become more and more expensive over the course of the last couple of generations. I mean, there was a time not that long ago when education in the States was either free or affordable, as it is in much of Latin America and in much of Europe. Those countries are aware of the fact that free education, or at least affordable education, is just good for economic mobility. It's just good for the entire country if people have an opportunity to study for free or affordably. This is a dynamic that changed in the U.S. as part of a backlash to the civil rights movement, actually. And I want to shout out Heather McGee, who has a fantastic book called The Sum of Us that really delves deep into this issue.
And in that case, when it comes to tech, would you say that meritocracy is essentially a myth then?
Absolutely. Yeah, meritocracy is a myth. Meritocracy is predicated on the idea that everybody has an equal opportunity to be as professionally successful as they are good at their craft. And that just isn't the case in the US.
When it comes to a field such as tech as well, institutions pay more attention to the college that a student has gone to as opposed to anything else. And especially if they've gone to an expensive college, it's not a fair playing field, is it?
Right. There's a certain degree of privilege in this. Yeah, the use of college as a filter by which to hire into tech is basically just it's a legally permissible way of identifying people who are within a certain class, right? And filtering out folks whose parents were not able to put them through college. That's basically what this is. A solid proportion of people in tech understand that you don't need a college degree in computer science and maybe not even a college degree at all in order to be a programmer. People understand this. And yet, both explicitly and implicitly, it remains a requirement for people to get an expensive degree in order to get those jobs. It's just a social demarcation.
I kind of got the impression from your book that those who are not in favor of the industry being more inclusive are the ones that kind of benefited from essentially having, you know, the free education or just more opportunity as opposed to younger generations that are now trying to kind of break through.
Yeah, that's right. I think most Americans don't necessarily realize that there was a flipping before the 1960s, back in the days of Franklin Roosevelt. Following the war, the federal government was still understood by white voters as upholding the traditional and racist hierarchy in America. And so everybody here talks about the GI Bill, which sent a whole generation of white veterans to college and black veterans to segregated trade schools. And this was okay with white voters. Now, in the age of Kennedy and Johnson, during the civil rights movement, there was a flipping there that happened where the federal government was suddenly understood by white voters as upending the traditional racist hierarchy in America. And so thus begins the divestment, right? The divestment away from public institutions. This is the beginning of the neoliberal takeover of American politics, divesting away from public institutions and ushering in an age of, the age of Reagan and Thatcher.
Thatcher and essentially over here as well. And I remember you mentioned a part in your book. I am paraphrasing here, so correct me if I'm saying it incorrectly, actually. It's just how much privatization takes away from the public. And it did make me think about the Thatcher era, essentially. A lot of things were privatized. I think that's around about the same era as Ronald Reagan as well, wasn't it?
Yep.
So what would you say could be done for tech to be more inclusionary rather than exclusionary?
Oh, there's a whole pile of things. Now, I can sit here and talk about programs, initiatives, efforts, legislation, rules, trainings, whatever. But the fact of the matter is that everything comes up from a foundation of culture, right? And so if your culture is not where your legislation is at, in other words, if you try to create legislation that is not firmly embedded in culture that people buy into, it's not really going to go very far. It's going to be ignored. And so while I can sit here and talk about programs, initiatives, efforts, and this, that, and the other thing, what really matters more than anything else is a deep fundamental shift in tech culture towards one that is of inclusion. Now, I think a lot of people don't necessarily realize that tech is fundamentally an exclusionary culture. It's like you have to be smart enough to be on this side of the velvet rope. Right. And now smart enough comes with a whole lot of biases and privileges and understandings of or like pedigree in college and all that kind of stuff. And so when tech can adopt a culture of mutual come up, right, mutualism, like people wanting the best from each other in order to rise up as a team or as an institution or as a company, then we will start to see the very beginnings of a reasonable conversation around equity in tech.
So essentially championing competitiveness, but it being more of a level playing field for all, as opposed to an opportunity for just a small group of people or a small pool of the same kind of people, essentially, if that's the right way to put it.
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, tech has like a very sort of libertarian streak, right? Which is to say, you know, I'm out for myself and I'm going to go disrupt XYZ industry with my awesome startup. And that's cool. And that's exciting and romantic, right? But it also leads to a culture of exclusion. Of if you can't hang, then you don't belong here. Like if you didn't spend your weekend coding, teaching yourself the cool new programming language or framework, you are lesser than.
What's your thoughts on self-directed learning as opposed to starting off with a degree? Because I got the impression from your book that self-directed learning is as effective, but once again, it goes down to the point of whether one has the opportunity to do it to begin with.
Absolutely. I mean, self-directed learning is one of those things that sounds meritocratic when you hear about it. But the fact of the matter is that not everybody has the time. I mean, self-directed learning requires free time, right? Not everybody has free time. Now, a lot of the engineers that I have met over the years will say something like, hey, I can hire anybody. I don't care what their background is, as long as they can build an application from soup to nuts in, you know, XYZ programming language. But the fact of the matter is that some people are able to teach themselves a cool new programming language, and some people are at their job or jobs or caring for children, you know. And so we have to be cognizant of the fact that even self-directed learning comes with a certain degree of privilege for some.
And just from the outside looking in when it comes to tech, is it one of those things where if you learn how to do it and you consistently do it, you can become essentially quite accomplished at it? So it's not, so to speak, just what you studied at college alone that's meant to qualify you for whether you're good or not at it.
That's exactly right. It's a trade. People tend to respond poorly to this idea because there's a certain cultural mysticism, right? We do the same thing today with banking, right? Bankers like to pretend that there's a certain like mysticism around the magic that they perform, but it's a trade. And by trade, I mean anybody can learn how to do it. Programming is the same. You don't need to be a genius to be a programmer. You just need to learn how to do it.
Comes to just the underrepresentation of Latinx and African Americans in programming, you mentioned in the earlier chapters of the book just how there's an overrepresentation of them in industries such as the trucking industry, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. So the idea of, I've heard this a couple of times actually, the idea of, okay, well, you have people here who are doing a job which might go to, like, let's say, the robots in X amount of time. How about you teach them to code? Is it as simple as just saying that though, David? Or is there deeper things? Yeah, what are the deeper things at play here, would you say?
Yeah, I think that there are some people who are like, let's just teach everybody to code. And look, I get it. Like, I get the energy, right? But that's just not going to be appropriate for everybody. And I mean, not everybody wants to, should be a programmer. The economy can't sustain everybody being a programmer, right? And so I think we still need to manage an economy in which people can just be what they want to be and are good at and is accessible and fulfilling to them, for sure. It should be a path that people can choose to take, not that they have to take. And it cannot be the only path.
That's the thing. Just the opportunity, more than anything else, isn't it?
Right.
And that's the issue here, that the opportunity doesn't necessarily exist for everyone, especially when you consider, as you said, a place such as Boston, where there's underrepresentation of minorities, when you consider how prominent the industry of coding is.
Yep, exactly.
There's another thing I want to run by you, actually, and it's the concept of liberty. And it's true that many focus on the idea of having freedom from constraint. But do you mind touching on how not just having freedom from, but why having freedom to is very important, David?
Yes. Here in my country, we like to twist the word freedom sort of political gain, right? There's an obsession, especially on the right, around the word freedom, but it is an incomplete interpretation of freedom. Freedom, according to Isaiah Berlin, is two different things. There's freedom from and there's freedom to, right? According to his essays on the two concepts of liberty, I believe the essay is called. Freedom from is easy enough, right? Like, there isn't a dictator telling you what you can and cannot do. So you are free from the dictator. But the absence of a dictator does not inherently mean that you have a representative democracy. That you also have to have the tools or the assets or the path through which to build the dictator's alternative. Which is to say that it's not enough. You are not free to just walk into a coding job if you don't have the time or resources to get there. So it's not just freedom from, we need freedom to. This is also part of the philosophy undergirding the neoliberal takeover of the 70s and 80s. There's an idea championed by Milton Friedman that somebody who is upset at their job can just walk out. Can they though? I actually know very few people who have that privilege who can just walk out of a job whenever without having something else lined up. And if you don't have the training, which is more and more and more expensive every day, how are you going to walk out on that job? For us to maintain the myth that anybody can just play musical chairs, get up, walk out, and go somewhere else is, first of all, wrong. And second of all, demoralizing to the people who are in a situation where they believe that they should be able to just get up and get trained and get this other job, and they just can't, right? This is another instance, and maybe this is a very American thing, but this is another instance of blaming the oppressed for their own oppression, right? Why didn't you just get up and do this thing? Why didn't you just get up and train yourself and go get this amazing job paying you a bajillion dollars a year? And presenting it as a choice makes it somebody's fault.
What would you say is your thoughts on diversity training as well, David?
I think it's theater. Do you know what I mean? Like, I know a lot of DEI trainers and professionals, and they're wonderful people and they do great work. But I think the power structure behind it, right? The people paying for it, the reason that it exists as a, I don't know how many billion dollar industry, it's an industry in which nobody knows what the goal is. There's no goal. If there's no explicitly stated goal, how do you measure if it worked? And if you don't know whether or not it worked, what is this industry? I know too many people, I know too many Black and Brown, Latino, Latinx people who don't feel particularly represented at work by their DEI team. And that's not to the fault, that's not necessarily the fault of the DEI team or professionals. It's the power structure undergirding the entire industry.
And it being performative, is this almost as if it's like in response to an occasion or an event? Because I remember at one, I don't know whether it was in this particular point in the book, but you raised a very good point when you said something along the lines of BLM to the left mm-hmm. is like what thoughts and prayers are to the right.
Yeah.
That was a good point. So
Yeah.
So is it something along them lines in terms of almost as in response to what's going on here? We'll have this diversity and inclusion exercise or training or program, but in the long run, it doesn't essentially change much. It's still a performative but ineffective action, essentially, or proposition.
Yeah, look, I don't care what people, I don't care about what people say, right? I care about what people do. Mm-hmm. And so for people to come out and make all these, what you're talking about is the murder of George Floyd. And for people to come out after the murder of George Floyd and make a bunch of statements of solidarity and followed up with nothing, what even is that? Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean? And to me, solidarity is not something you express, it's something that you exercise, you enact, you put into motion. And I think that there are a lot of, I do think that there are a lot of business leaders who do want to get it right. I do. I've met some of them. But DE&I is basically, has been in many instances, I don't want to say this is across the board, but it has been in many instances a replacement for actual action. And there have been too many companies that I have been to as a leader of Resilient Coders where I speak to a DE&I person and they're like, all right, cool. We really love what you're doing at Resilient Coders. Like, how can we partner? How can we help? And I say, hire people of color and pay them market rate according to their talent and their will. And you know what they said? Oh, let's see if I can connect you to someone in talent acquisition. What do you do here? Like, what is your role? What are you doing? And the entire concept of training, like how trained up can somebody be? This industry has been bopping for 3 years now. Like, it doesn't take that long to train for a marathon. Like, how much training do you need? And I wonder whether the industry has stagnated in that there doesn't appear to be much development or growth. And again, this isn't everybody. I also know some really innovative DE&I efforts and initiatives. But generally speaking, it's an industry kind of unchanged in the last 3 years. As long as you're not actually connecting people with jobs and supporting them, retaining them on the jobs and advancing them.
So what has the experience been for some of the people that's gone through Resilient Coders when they've gone into the open market for jobs? How have things been for them as well, David, would you say?
Well, it's kind of been up and down. So since the pandemic, we were doing really great before the pandemic. And I think one of the unexpected consequences of the way that work has changed since the pandemic is that people don't have the same opportunity to establish in-person relationships with their colleagues. Now, the reason this matters is that you are way easier to fire, right? If I don't know you, if I don't have a relationship with you. And the other thing is that a lot of our alumni were going to work for new managers. So you got a 24-year-old kid who has no idea what the hell they're doing, how to manage people. And there are two types of managers in the world, right? There are managers who believe that you fundamentally want to be doing your job, and so their role is to support you. And there are managers who believe that you fundamentally do not want to be doing your job, and their role is to surveil you. And you cannot separate that out from racial bias, right? And so if you have a manager who thinks that you fundamentally don't want to be doing your job and they surveil you, they're going to surveil you until they can find a reason to fire you. And this is something that spiked since work went remote. It was never a problem before, but once people don't have the opportunity to establish real relationships with people, what ends up happening is that their managers, who never wanted them on their team in the first place, move the goalposts. So here's the goalpost, boom, let's see if you can do that. And our alumni are ride or die. And so they do it. They just don't sleep that week, and they do it. And so the goalpost is moved, and it's moved, and it's moved until a person can't hit it. And ultimately they're fired. And this happens too much for it to be a fluke. I ran into an alum a couple weeks ago, and you know, she said, "Oh, you know, I actually lost my job." And I was like, "Hold up, let me guess." And I just said all that to her, and she was like, "That's literally, I mean, exactly how it happened."
Wow.
Yeah.
So David, off the back of that, you mentioned in like the later chapters, the things that just CEOs can do. How can CEOs just go about changing this kind of, let's say, atmosphere in the workplace of where they're the boss, where in most cases or not, they're the CEO to make, you know, the company money or to make profit and et cetera. But beyond that, what can they do in order to combat what you were just saying?
You know, I actually think that it's less about what the CEO can do and about what workers can do. Because I have spoken to so many software engineers who will be in this conversation with me, and they say, "Yeah, man, like I'm 100% with you, but there's nothing I can do. I'm just a lowly software engineer. I don't have any power." To which I say, you might be a member of the most empowered workforce in the history of the workforce, right? If you can band together with your colleagues and develop a collectively held position and say, "Look, we in this company, we believe that we should have better representation of Black and Latinx people. And we're willing to do some training and some mentorship management if people don't have a degree, people don't have a background in tech." And they present that to the CEO. That's way more powerful than something that the CEO can cook up in the corner office.
So the last thing I actually want to ask you, David, is what would you like or what would you want the ideal thing to be for the future of resilient coders and just those who go through the resilient coders path as well?
I think it needs to be an established pipeline into high growth careers. You know, just like college. The same way that you don't get a college degree to become a carpenter, right? Which is a highly skilled job. You shouldn't need a degree to become a programmer. There are a variety of different paths that you can take to become a carpenter. And they usually involve some degree of apprenticeship. Like you do a pre-apprenticeship training, and then you do an apprenticeship. And there's no reason why programming can't be very similar. I think Resilient Coders has a role to play in that pipeline. I think that we are going to have to do some degree of on-the-job training within tech to see any sort of a shift. And we're going to have to see a material shift in tech culture for us to even begin the conversation.
That was David Delmar Centillas, author of the book What We Build With Power, The Fight for Economic Justice in Tech. The book and audiobook is available now, which I do recommend you to pick up and read or to give a listen to. A big thank you to David for coming on the podcast, and thank you for listening to this episode. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate the podcast and check out some of the previous ones if you haven't done already. And until then, I'll catch you on the next.